1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean, I wasn't us.
They get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into a very special episode 58 of The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and on today's show, I'm joined by a man of many lives, all of them incredibly interesting. His name is Aidan Gabor. Now, Aidan is a former associate of organized crime, police officer, and a DOJ informant, which is more than enough action for any given lifetime. But more than that, his story is one of redemption, more unique than almost any that you'll find in the organized crime genre. So it's here that I'd like to highly recommend that you all go check out Aidan Gabor's new book, Conflicting Loyalties. Because while we'll talk about a good amount of its subject matter, it's just a cannot-miss book. And this interview simply can't do the complexities of Aidan's life anywhere near as much justice as the incredible book that he's written. So it's truly an honor to be joined by him for today's episode. Aidan, how are you today?
Bliss, I'm doing great. It's an honor to be on your show, sir.
I really appreciate that. And when I do, and I'm sure the fans will, just really appreciate you being here with us today. So, the first question I have, and one of the things that I find really interesting about your come up, really, is you talk about in the book, your mother is from Hungary, and more than that, she left in 1956 during a really turbulent time in the Hungarian Revolution. Is that something that you could talk about?
Oh, absolutely. Both my parents left in 56. They were both partisans. And they were going against the communist government with the Russians. And so they both escaped because they were told by my father first, was told by his father that you need to go because they're looking for you. And two of his friends were never seen again that were by the KGB caught, I guess, whoever it was at that time. And so they're both gone. And so my father got my mother, who was part of the group, and they both escaped in 1956.
That's incredible. That's truly incredible. So you talk about that you came up in a New Jersey city called The Bluffs. Is that where your family initially settled when they came to the United States?
Yep, they just settled down there. My father started doing work there, and that's how everything kind of rollballed for me with the area.
And if you don't mind me asking, what did your parents do for a living when you first arrived here?
Well, my father was an engineer, so he worked for various places, railroads, a couple other, and just different companies like that. And my mother was basically a stay-at-home, and then she did some modeling work, and that was about it.
Oh, very nice, very nice. So if you could explain to us, I've never heard of the Bluffs before. Could you explain maybe geographically where that is in New Jersey?
It's south of Philly. It's more going towards it's heading east, a little east, southeast of it. It's an area that's surrounded by, you know, to the northwest is Philadelphia, so it's more of an area that's it's Italian / you name gangs, all that. Right now it's kind of turned, so it's all different ethnic people in there.
Definitely. And you talk about in the book that when you came up in the Bluffs, it was heavily populated by gangs. I think you talk specifically about maybe the Vice Lords, I think, and a couple of other ones. So definitely an area heavily influenced by organized crime. which brings me to my next point. Could you talk about when you first maybe got introduced to organized crime, or when you first started to participate in organized crime?
Well, everything started with me when I was about 8 or 9, and, you know, just doing stupid things. But when I got to about 10, I started riding my bike and dropping things off. They would say, drop this off and pick up this. Don't look at it. Just bring it to me. And I would do it, and we would get money. I would. And I would run to the little local mom-and-pop places and get candy or whatever at the time. There's places called Ben Franklin's that we went to, and we would get the candy and all kinds of stuff. And so we would get that, and then it kind of started going up from there. As I got older, we had like family gatherings where the mothers and grandmothers would cook, and my mom would be part of it, and the kids would go all together, and I used to get in little scuffles. And I was big for my age, and they would beat up on kids that were 4 or 5 years older than me, and they're like, you know, they're looking at me. I never got upset about, I broke one of my buddy's arms, and I never even, I just laughed at him the whole time. So Eddie kind of looked at me and said, okay, you okay, buddy? And I'm like, yeah, this is fun. And when I started doing, just started moving more up, and got to the point where I would help collect money and kind of enforce things, and it just kind of went up from there. And that's basically what I did. I was more enforcing. There's several things that we did. You know, we had gambling, we had loans, we had prostitution, but we never, Eddie's first thing he said, we don't touch the drugs. You let the gangs have that in their area, let them to deal with that. And that's kind of the little, I guess you would say, treaty we had with the gangs, that we kind of worked together on certain things.
Definitely. And that's definitely a common theme in the mafia in New York and Chicago. I just want to clarify real quick. Aiden mentioned a guy named Eddie there a couple of times. That is a man he refers to as Eddie Tosino, who was a lieutenant for the DeCavalcanti family, a really big New Jersey mafia family for a long time, probably still somewhat active today, I would say.
Yeah, a little bit. I wouldn't say, I mean, I really haven't talked to anybody in 20 years.
No, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I had to go up there a couple years ago with an issue with one of my kids that was getting involved, and I had to have a chat with a couple people, and we got that straightened out, and he no longer has any ties or anything like that.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that we're going to get into a little bit down the road, because it's certainly an interesting point in your life. So, you started early. You kind of had somewhat of a Henry Hill, Goodfellas upbringing, I would say. So around your later teens, you're somewhat of an enforcer to Eddie Tosino. And what time is this? Is this about the mid-80s?
Yeah, it's the mid-80s. It's actually early mid-80s.
Okay. And so for a little bit further context, by the mid-80s, the DeCavalcanti was led, I think, by a man named John Riggi. And it was also around this time that the family was facing some pretty big pressure and some major RICO trials. Did you guys experience any pressure from that?
Yeah, that's what caused the whole crew to kind of break up because they were taking on a couple of guys, and we had a guy named Nicky that was there, and he was the older one that ran with Eddie. I didn't really talk about him in the book, but he was one of the first to go. And then Eddie's like, you know what, you need to, you know, I was good at sports, and they're like, you need to go play ball, and you need to do something better and get out of this, because see what's happening right now? And I'm like, okay. And he's like, I'm going, and I just need you a couple things. Then he gave me a couple things he wanted me to do, keep an eye on his kid and stuff, who was very young at the time. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And he left. And so at that point, I decided to go to school. And that's where I went to college. And Everything at that point with the RICO and FBI is dropping out on top of everybody at that time.
Definitely. And like you said, even though you're really deep into this very serious life at this point, you're still a very young guy, speaking relatively. You're what, 17, 18, and okay. And if I'm correct, you accepted a football scholarship to Michigan State?
Yep, I went and played ball, and as I was there, one day these two goofballs in suits show up, and I'm like, okay, what's up with this? And they start talking to me, and they told me for D-Day, and they showed me pictures of me with Eddie and them, and my mother with Eddie and my father, you know, being stupid, not knowing anything. And after everything around happened, they were telling me that I'm looking at like 70 years with RICO because of organized crime. They know what I did. They have all this. They've had people said they talked to me, which was a bunch of bullshit I found out later. And I was just worried. And they said, well, we want you to do this. And I'm like, what? Well, here, we want you to think about it. We need you to come work with us. We need you to drink your way out of school. And then we got some things we want you to do back towards home. And I kind of at that time told them to fuck off. And I kind of, they told me to think about it, and I went back. And then about a month and a half later, they showed back up and said, what do you think? Do you want to take a chance to go to jail? And I'm like, what do you need me to do? And they had me basically just drink myself out of school. And then I went and they told me to try to get on this department. And my first department I got on, they were telling me they were wanting me to look for this guy. Well, I had no idea who he is until I met him. And I realized, oh, I've seen this idiot before. And it took a while because he was being a police officer and on his moonlighting as a hitman.
Okay, and so right here we're talking about a corrupt cop and, like you say, a suspect of multiple murders in Terry McPherson?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, and when were you tasked by the DOJ to sort of investigate him or get close to him?
Well, they came to me and they said, get out of school, and I did. And then I met up with them. They said, here, this is what we want you to do. We want you to get on this department, and we want you to basically talk to, get on, and we want you to get by this guy. And I'm like, okay, his name's Terry. And when I got on, I didn't know who he was. And everybody he's kind of a loner. And at that point, we kind of started like, okay, I'll see about going out for drinks with this guy. After a while, he goes, I know you. You ran with Eddie's crew and stuff. And I'm like, okay. I go, you don't need to be telling anybody that shit. And he's like, no, I don't. And he just started telling me guys he knew. And I'm like, okay, half of them I'd never even heard of. And he's telling me stuff. And then after a couple months drinking, he was a pretty good gulper. Started telling me, because I know I wanted to do what you did, but I'm doing it. I'm working out now. You got your own angles. I'm like, yeah, I got angles. I'm not doing anything stupid enough, but I'm just doing my angles. So after a couple drinks, he was explaining to me stuff he was doing, and I wasn't wearing a wire or anything like that. And I went and I told these guys, and they go, are you sure? I go, yeah. This is what he's doing. He goes, but this is what he explained to me. He goes, great. Can you get a recording of it? And then one looked, he goes, no, because we want you as an informant. We don't need you to be there's another word they use, because it's a one and done deal. We need you to do several things because we have something else here. We're just checking on this. And so then I after a while I went over there, and then his wife just started crying and talking to me one day, and that she can't take it anymore. And I'm like, oh, don't worry, you need to shut up about this shit, and just all this stuff on. Just tell her to be quiet. And, Terry kept talking, and I'm looking at him thinking, okay, wow, right, well, you need to shut the fuck up, but okay. And he just told me more, so I went and told these guys, and I said, you got to pump the wife. She's the one that's going to, she'll cave on him. She's already killing her right now. And sure enough, that's what they did. They wanted just the information because they said, I'm going in as a informant. I'm not going in undercover or anything because I'm not going to have any backup. If something goes wrong, it's more like the, oh, well. And they told me this going in. Oh, well, you're not going to have anything. This is all you. This is how you keep yourself safe. And you do what you got to do to keep yourself safe. And
so
that's how that first one that ended up.
So behind that, were you ever nervous during your first assignment? I'd have to imagine.
You know, I was and I wasn't because, you know, when you're young, you don't have any the wisdom that you do. I didn't care if I was going to die or get killed or anything. I mean, I wasn't worried about it, never thought about it. And yeah, I was a little nervous thinking, boy, this guy's like, but it, you know, at the time, it didn't bother me. It really didn't. And then, you know, eventually later in life, I find out that I have no empathy. I got some kind of disorder that I don't care if somebody's hurt. It doesn't, unless they're family or a very close friend, I don't give a shit. And with this guy saying what he was doing, it really didn't dawn on me. Didn't care. I thought, okay, it sucks to be them. But then I thought eventually that, whoa, this guy is just a big wannabe, but he's not right in the head. And because he was just like, you know, I'm going to do more. I mean, I might even do it for free. I'm like, yeah, okay. Now you're past business. Now, I mean, that's a little different. So I that's what I told him about, and they basically pumped the wife and got him his for a couple of the murders.
Yeah, definitely. And he was arrested by the FBI in was it 1987?
Something like that.
There about.
Yeah, the 80s. Yeah, around 87, 88, around there.
Okay, and it's actually around that same time that you. You tried to get yourself, or you did get yourself transferred back to the station in the Bluffs. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, actually, that was the 90s, I believe.
Oh, 90s.
It was early
okay.
90s. Maybe it was like 89. And then, yeah, they asked me, okay, we want you to get on the department. And they said, the Bluffs. I'm like, oh, shit, really? He goes, oh, you know, everybody knows you there. We need you to get in. They're not going to expect anything. Their logic was, we're going to send a snake into the snake pit and see what happens. That kind of, you know, the saying. They were going to send, you know, somebody that they're not going to look at that's going to figure, okay, we got just another ass in here. You know, the other one's going to do what they need to do. And I got on that department, and as I was getting on, I knew the mayor and the commissioner, and they both looked at me, and the first thing was said, you know, Aiden, you're going to toe a line, right? You're going to do what needs to be done, need to be told. I go, yes, sir. Says, I know you because I know from where you ran with, and you were good. You were good with these guys. He said, you listened and did your thing. He says, we need that here. And I'm like, okay. And that's how that all started in the Bluffs.
Oh, definitely. Okay. And so the next assignment that you talk about in the book for the DOJ was... you were put onto, I believe, the head of narcotics, a man named Jeff Walters, who you talk about was suspected of passing information to the Vice Lord Street Gang, as well as repackaging seized drugs and reselling them.
Yeah, it was more of a, I knew this bozo, and I kind of thought to myself, okay, and then I knew what he was doing. But I didn't really think about it until I got in there and just observing him. And one night they hit a gang, a different street gang, and I'm not sure how many keys they got there. And they went to a warehouse and they were repackaging it. And at the warehouse, I knew the kid that ran it. It was a kid I knew younger. He's a little younger than me. But we used to deal with, when I was younger, his brothers. And they always ran that little shop they went into. And they used it as like one of the little hiding things. So I asked him, hey, you got any tape that these things? He goes, yeah, we got surveillance cameras. I'm like, can you get me a video? And he gave me his cartridge and I gave it to the guy. And they just kind of laughed. How'd you get this shit? I'm like, don't worry about how I got it. Just here it is. And it shows them doing everything. And that's how basically those two idiots got pinched on it.
Oh, so you definitely had them dead to rights. You had them cold.
Yeah, they were, you know, I talked to them, and so I really didn't care for them. So we kind of kept their distance, but, you know, I knew what they were doing, and then I knew where they were going, and that made it so easy. That first one was easy as can be.
Definitely a layup for you. And so around this time, I believe you talk about in the book, Eddie was arrested in Portugal?
Yeah, he was arrested in Spain, I believe, playing Portugal, somewhere in that area. He was about to, when he was over there, I was told, hey, go to this payphone. And by somebody just dropped a note, just like walking by, and I went. So I went over to this payphone at this gas station. It was Eddie. And he called and he says, you know what, I'm not sure how much time I got. Now, this is like 7-8 months before he was caught. And he's like, can you just do me, keep an eye on my kid and just make sure everything's going all right. And I said, all right, well, you know, he really loved his kid. And that's what got him in. He got in trouble by the wife, and they set him up with the FBI, and that's how they caught him, using the kid. And I've kept in touch with his son to this day. And so, you know, he got caught, and then it kind of was a kick in the nuts for me with that, because I was hoping he never got caught, but in my mind, I knew he eventually would be. And, yeah, that was a pretty... bad day for me when I found out that.
So was that the last time that you ever talked to Eddie?
Yep, that was it on that phone. It was the last time.
Oh my gosh.
He said, God, you know, God bless, love you, and that was it.
That's terrible. Is he still around today?
No, he's passed. He's passed. Oh. So, everybody from that day is just about dead. I mean, everybody I dealt with, the whole crew, I'm the last one. Everybody's passed. I mean, it's been 4 years. So, yeah, they're pretty much either died in prison or died of natural causes or died of lead poisoning. One of the three.
Definitely. Definitely. So the next assignment for the DOJ after Jeff Walters and after you talked to Eddie that time, I believe, was the head of detectives, actually, a man named George Pellegrino. Around 1990?
Yeah, it was like 91, 92, George. Well, maybe a little bit later with George. He was a cocky son of a bitch, but he didn't like me. I mean, he knew him. I ran into him, you know, a couple times when I was younger. We see him at, like, I've seen him at the shop, and he would be there sitting there with Eddie and bullshitting, and I made fun of him because there was a couple FBI guys there with him, and I was like, wow, are you a G-man? And go, well, are you a policeman? And they showed me their badges, and I kind of laughed, and I walked away just being like, okay. And then as I got older, I realized, you know, what a bunch of shitheads. And then he's like talking to me, and then he said, well, you know, the guys are saying, you're good, you're going to toe the line. I'm like, yeah, okay. And a couple of times he caught me following. I was trying to figure out what he was doing. And I saw him hanging out with the gangs. And the one time we were coming up the stairs, and he turned around and put a gun in my face. And I looked at him, and my first thinking, I'm thinking, okay, what the fuck? And then my first, I said, you know what? You can do what you want. Because he says, what are you doing? Who are you working for? And I looked at him, I go, I've got my own thing, you got your own thing going. I go, you know what? You know, you're always wanting to be what I was. You know, you were a cog. You could be replaced. I was part of the machine. I was part of the main thing. If I went down, the whole thing went down. You, who gives a shit? I go, you're a wannabe. You want to be what I did. And he just looked at me, and I'm like, and I'm looking down this barrel of this clock, and I'm thinking, all right, you know, do what you got. And I told him, you do what you got to do. I don't know how you're going to get through this, but I'm sure you figure something out. But if you do, you got to understand, there's probably people that are going to be behind my ass after your ass, because I got my own shit going. And he just kind of pulled away, laughed, and said, all right, I just had to check. He goes, all right. And then we went up there, and that's where I saw the commissioner and them sitting up there. And my buddy happened to be working there too, a guy I grew up with, and that was Don. And he overheard them talking. He happened to make a coffee and hear them talking. I told you, Aiden is a total line. Don't you start shit with him. He goes, I just want to make sure. And he came over and told me, he goes, what the fuck's going on? And I said, I don't know. They're just being assholes. And Yeah, that's where it started. Don kind of started figuring shit out at that point.
And so did George Pellegrini, did he end up getting arrested, or how did that play out?
Oh yeah, he got it. He ended up getting arrested because he was hanging on, giving information and taking money from the gangs. And there was one time he was involved in a murder that I actually witnessed, but they blew up as, you know what, there's no way you could prove it, yada yada yada, and nobody ever did anything on it. And so they got him for extortion, and they got him for, I believe, with the gangs, giving information, taking money, and laundering. I mean, he got a whole list of shit, and he ended up getting like 70 years in prison.
Oh gosh. And so around that time, he wasn't the only one. I think Mayor Paul Ciolino and Police Chief Chuck Lewandowski also went away.
Yeah, actually, it was a commissioner, and then the
Commissioner.
I'm that I, yeah, I think it was a commissioner. They had a couple other guys with them that were little cronies, but yeah, they all got it for federal charges for racketeering and all that. And those are easy ones too. I just got and said, hey, this is where you need to go. This is the businesses they're doing shit with, and they're like, oh, okay. And yeah, that was kind of my towards the end. I remember when they got it. And everybody, I get a call from Don. He's like, what the fuck's going on? All these zones are going down. And what the hell's going on? Somebody in here is ratting out everybody. And if you're working law enforcement, you got this thing called a blue line. And you don't cross it. And while I was doing all of this, I became a very bad, a heavy drinker. And I don't know how many times I played Russian roulette where I would actually I had a 357. And I actually put a chain, put around in a chamber and spun it. And I hit you over 500 times. I clicked that chamber, putting it to my head and in my mouth. And I was drunk as can be, most of the night. And I cold sweats. I would look, I would see the patron Saint Michael with the flaming sword coming at me and just having hallucinations. And it got pretty bad. And I'm thinking to. Am I doing? I'm going against my brothers in blue, but I'm doing it. And anybody else, man, I'm thinking I'm doing good, getting rid of the bad ones because every one bad police officer makes 10,000 look bad. 10,000 good ones, all it takes is one, and everybody thinks they're all bad. So I had to really fight my own demons to get through all this. And Don is the one to help me get through just about 99% of everything I really went through.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Like the book title says, that you had conflicting loyalties. It's definitely a hard job to have. And it was it around this time that you decided that you wanted to step away from informing and as well as just the street life in general?
You know, I was debating on it. You know, when everybody heard, so everybody's leaving the department, and they said, "Hey, can you do me a favor? We need you to do me a favor. We need you to go to a casino." I said, "Are you shitting me? I'm not a really big gambler. I may gamble on, a game now and then, but are you kidding me? Yeah, go do this." So they had me get into the security part of it, and I would be able to look at everything. First, they wanted me to look at a couple of these owners, and they were more like frat boys. And I'm like, there is nothing with him. And then another one came in, and he was definitely cooking the books and stuff. And being a security, I wanted nights, which everybody kind of, where I'm like, oh, I got day stuff I got to do. And at night, when you're in security, you got keys to everything. And after, this is several years, I would say like 4 or 5 years into it, I got into the office and I just took pictures of some files in there and stuff and doing my rounds, and there's no cameras up there. And I turned them in and they're like, well, this is what we needed. And whatever they did with this, they did something with the owner, and it ended up getting to new ownership. And after that, they kind of said, hey, thanks for everything. We were thinking about maybe putting would you want me to do witness protection? I go, for what? I go, first of all, I was a mama's boy. I can't. They said, we need to leave your family. You need to leave your, I'm like, I'm not leaving my mother. And at the time, my ex was, she was a real bitch that, no, we can't, why you need to do this? And I never told her anything. And then I think, okay, we'll give you a stipend. And they gave me some money. And I'm like, oh, this is for when I got hurt. Oh, okay. This is, she bought that because I got injured a couple times. And she ended up burning the money to her family. And that's what really caused us to get divorced. So that was at the end of it. And that was the end. And then at the casino, I met Sabrina, which is my wife now, who at that time I was still in a bad place. I was still, you know, seeing the stuff and doing the Russian roulette and drinking. And she straightened my ass out. And she's like, you know, you need to do this and you need to be a better person. And it took a long time. I mean, our first month together, we did a swear jar. And I had $800 in there. And she had one, it was the whatever or fine jar. And she had like $150 in there. But I had $800 just for my swear jar alone for 1 month. And in 6 months, I think I had like $4,000 or $5,000 in that thing. But eventually I got better. I don't swear as much as I used to.
No, definitely. Definitely seems like you met your match.
Yes, absolutely. And she's one straight me out. And then my buddy Sam, I've always been in touch with. He's been through my whole life. And he came up and he's like, you need to look at this. So he gave me writings on this faith called the Baha'i Faith. And I was very anti anything with religion. I used to joke that I worked for the other guy. I would get clients for the other guy. That's what I did. I was over collecting souls. And I've been reading the faith, and I'm a believer. I do classes 4 times a week, and I've realized that there's something more out there spiritually, that everybody needs something. And the Baha'i Faith has definitely changed around between Sabrina's love and teaching me, and she's supported me through all of this. And took classes with me, did everything with me, and she's not going to convert to being a Baha'i. She's staying her religion, and not many women would do that. Most people think, first of all, what is a Baha'i, number one? Number two, are you nuts? And that's kind of some people, like my friends of mine, that don't understand a religion are like, oh, God, you're one of them. So, and like my buddy Don, staying his or who's Catholic, he's not going to change, but he's been supporting me in classes and all that too.
Definitely. So that's about where your life is right now. You have Sabrina, you have your faith, you left your old life behind, and that's something that I think is not only entertaining but truly admirable, and something that not a lot of people could do, especially in the life, or at least as deep as you were.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think anybody could change their life on with the spirit of a God, of God, and of a high faith, or whatever faith you're into. It will help you to change, you know. I also have ALS, which is a kick in the teeth, but right now with medication and all that, it's kind of staying, it's in stage one. But, you know, I'm looking at that as a payback. That's my, you know, everybody's got karma, everything comes back. That's my karma. I did what I did when I was young, and it's coming back. Everything's a full circle. It's coming back to get me, and I understand that. I'm not worried. I'm not afraid of anything. But I understand God is up there, and that he will forgive anybody. I don't care. You could be the cesspool of life. You could be the low person doing things that normal people shouldn't be doing, and yet you can change your life around with the belief, and you have a good support group, as I do in Sam and Sabrina and Don and friends like that, that really stand behind you and do anything for you as I would do anything for them.
Absolutely. That's why I think that your story is entertaining but also very important to anyone who wants to change. I think that you have been through just about every challenge that someone can, regardless of in the street or not. And like I said before, I just think it's very commendable. That's Aiden Gabor's story. It's, like I said, an incredibly interesting, very intricate story. And like I said, we talked about a lot of the things in the book today, though not in depth. So I really can't recommend enough that anybody listening go pick up his book, Conflicting Loyalties. It is beyond a doubt or without a doubt, one of my favorite books, and definitely my favorite in the organized crime genre. So, Aiden, I just want to say again, thank you so much for being on the show today. I wish you the best of health. I wish you the best of luck with your faith. I wish you and your family the best of health, Sabrina. But once again, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything that you would like to say before we close this one out?
I just want to say this. It's been an honor being with you. I'd love to chat anytime, even if it's
off. That's really all I have for you guys today. I really hope everyone thoroughly enjoyed the first interview on the show and checks out Aiden Gabor's new book, Conflicting Loyalties. Because I'd really love to have him on the show again at some point, so if you'd like to learn more about him for that time, there's no better place to do that than in his book. Next week, however, we hit the ground running once again with our series on the history of deputy gangs. Honors all mine, thank you, and have an amazing day. Which we'll pick up on in part 5. So a really quick disclaimer. You might notice a small hiccup in the episode listings, as this will technically be episode 58, released between parts of episode 57, which might make it look a little weird. But I thought it'd be good to have a quick break from the series, as well as the fact that I wanted this interview to be released as soon as possible. So, just keep that in mind when you're scrolling through. Other than that, if you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod. But with that said, I hope everyone has a great rest of their day. This is your host, Bliss Grieve, signing out.